Namaste and in Lakech. Welcome to this episode of One World and a New World. I'm your host, Zen Benefiel. And before we get any further, I want you to contemplate those two phrases. Namaste comes from the Sanskrit spoken. It's in the Brahmi, and it means the divine in me recognizes the divine in you. In Lakech, from the other side of the world, comes from the Mayans, which means I am another you. So imagine if we look into each other's eyes and acknowledge each other in that way when you're on the street, even with strangers, what kind of difference that'll make to you and to them. Just think about that. Try it out. See what happens. So this week's episode is with Dr. Melissa Hughes, who is just this wonderful neuroscience geek. Right. She just loves the brain and how it works and the discovery process of all the inner workings. She has a doctorate in curriculum and instruction and a Master of Arts in Educational Administration. So she's really looking at not just the understanding, but how to impart that wisdom to others. And she does so in her business. She's the Florida Program Director for Give Something Back. She's the founder and principal of the Endrick Group, which is where she does her wonderful work with. And she's also a featured columnist and author on BizCatalyst 360. So we're going to have a great conversation about this. I've been looking forward to it. Melissa, welcome.
Thank you. Thank you for having me. It's a delight to be here.
It's delightful conversations with you always. So let's start with the beginning, right? And how did you first understand or have the inkling towards your passion for understanding how your brain works?
So my career started in a fourth grade classroom. So I was a fourth grade teacher. And I sat down with my mentor at the end of that first year and just kind of did a post-mortem, what worked well, what didn't work so well, what do you want to work on over the summer so that you can come back and be better in the fall. And my overarching question was, how can I be the best teacher I can be if I don't understand how the brain works and how the brain learns? And now, as I like to say, how the brain quirks. Like all of those things that, all of those factors that impact productivity, creativity, problem solving, all of those higher level executive functions that we'd like to think we hang out there all the time. And what I know now, which I wish I would have known then, is not so much. I mean, there are a lot of things happening in our subconscious that really do impact the way our cognition works and our mental acuity. And so my journey in neuroscience really started there. And
it's interesting that we do have such extraneous thinking, you know, and, you know, there's some who say, well, we don't like to think, but the fact is we're thinking all the time. It's not necessarily relevant.
All the time. And, you know, I mean, there was that myth at one point that we only use 10% of our brain, and that's completely untrue. What we know now, actually, we've discovered a lot since the 90s. The 1990s were named the decade of the brain, and that came from George H.W. Bush, and he solicited the help of the National Institutes of Health and National Institutes of Mental Health and said, we are getting so smart in the area of technology. Let's put that to work to understand more about our own internal computer, our brains.
Oh, and gosh, so, isn't that relevant? And there's mixed feelings about the Bush administration, but I agree that that is a wonderful direction to head. And perhaps, you know, that culmination was Mihaly Csikszentmihalyi being awarded the Thinker of the Year Award in 2000, right? Because he had that wonderful expression of flow, the psychology of optimal experience, right? Mm-hmm. Which I'm sure you're familiar with. Mm-hmm. So how did that move forward for you, and what were the perhaps even the practical applications of what you found to return back into the classroom or organizational development side of things?
Well, so that summer, that's when I really started to dig into, all right, so what exactly is going on in the brain when we learn something new? or when we're trying to learn something new, because in a classroom setting, that's what we really care about, is when our students, whether they be children or adults, when learners are trying to learn something, and either something happens to let the learning occur, or something happens to prevent the learning from occurring.
Mm-hmm.
And at that time, I was a teacher in Ohio, and at that time it was the first year for the Ohio proficiency test. And it was that the days of high stakes testing when they right. first started. And that year we spent more time on test taking skills and test preparation. And, you know, we sent flyers home all the time to mom and dad, make sure they get a good breakfast, make sure they get a good night's sleep. And all of that was well intended, but the unexpected byproduct was we were all stressed out. That stress, what I know now is emotional contagion, that stress we shared with our kids. And then what the kids walked into the classroom and we said, now do your very best. And what we know is that the brain just doesn't do its best thinking when it's
under pressure,
cortisol, like all over the place. So, you know, I started to really look at my role in how well those students performed on that high stakes test, and what my actions, how my behaviors, how my attitudes, how my actions impacted them. And that was really the beginning of the journey, because when you start to understand how cortisol impacts the brain, well, then you have to figure out how to counter that. Mm-hmm. And what I learned was that cortisol and the other, there are about six stress hormones, but cortisol and norepinephrine are the two that people know the most. They sit on one side of the neurological seesaw, and then all of our happy chemicals like dopamine, oxytocin, serotonin, and endorphins, they sit on the other side of the neurological seesaw. So when cortisol is pumping, the happy chemicals are not. But when the happy chemicals are pumping, cortisol and the stress hormones are not. And what is very significant about this is that the happy chemicals actually facilitate activity in the neocortex, or specifically the prefrontal cortex, which is all the, you know, higher level thinking. It's mm-hmm. the decision making, the impulse control, the planning, the organization, weighing risk and reward. And so it's like, as adults, you know, have you ever done something and you think, man, what was I thinking?
Often.
Often. And it's when we're...
Yeah, you know, I'm an experimenter, so, you know, that, you know, as you are as well. We take chances. We risk.
We take chances, but often when we have one of those what was I thinking moments, it was because we were not thinking. It was because our survival brain was engaged, our thinking brain was put on pause,
right,
and we were reacting, not responding to the situation.
Well, it may be in simple terms, when you're talking about that seesaw, is that the constrictive side keeps us from activating or actualizing those higher functions, and then the other side opens us up and gives us the freedom to explore. And, you know, and we've talked about this in a different way before, and that, you know, we really can't think our way through a system built on vibration.
Right.
Right. There's this sense and feeling that goes along that we're not only intuitively engaged with, whether we realize it or not, that it's a natural function that we have, mm-hmm. that we have limited because of our, whether it's belief systems, our proclivities to self-deprecation, and those kinds of things. And especially in those stress-filled situations where we feel like we have to perform at our best, and so there's that extra stress that then we don't realize transfers to the kids because they're in our immediate sphere of influence.
Absolutely. And you know, you think about just the interactions that we have. The coolest thing about all this that I learned back in that fourth grade classroom is that it doesn't become less important in the classroom of life. It actually becomes more important in the classroom of life. So You know, what you just said about, we can't think our way through vibrations. Well, we actually communicate. Everybody knows we communicate more through body language and facial expressions and posturing and all of that
Right.
than we do through
Yeah, I
actual
think that's
words.
a statistically, I think that's an 85%, right? And there's like 7% verbal.
And then the other piece of that is even when we're tuned in, even when we know that and we pay attention to that statistic and we're tuned into that, there are so many other things that our subconscious picks up and factors into the equation that we're not even aware of. So you think about these people who are micro expression experts,
Yeah.
right? And you can, and they
Don't
can
lie
pick
to me.
up, they
Or
can
no,
pick
it's
up
lie to
on,
me, isn't it? That was the name of the
lie
song.
to me. That's
Yeah.
exactly right. He could pick up exactly what that person was thinking. And you know, that sometimes that person doesn't even know that's really what their true emotion is in that moment. So, 10 years ago, when emotional intelligence came on the scene, that was really about understanding how am I feeling? Why am I feeling this? And only then could you then interpret. How are you feeling and why are you feeling this?
Or even be interested.
And in the business world, and now in the hybrid business world, that becomes even more important because, I mean, think about this. We're not having those traditional interactions in the hallway, in
Right.
the office space. We're not, I'm not going to see you when I go grab another cup of coffee and you're heating up your chicken noodle soup.
Oh, I had a perfect example of that. I do partnering workshops for Building Road and Bridge Construction. And last January, I did one for the Naval Corps of Engineers for a renovation of a base in Roanoke. And unbeknownst to me, the guys on the base couldn't use video. It was a base restriction. So I came into that thinking, all right, I'm going to be able to at least see their faces and have some interaction and be able to read those micro expressions, which are so amazingly important in situations like that. And it wasn't available. So now I'm having to listen even deeper to the intonation of the voice and hear what they're saying, but also understand what they're not saying, or at least have an inkling in order to be able to ask the questions to flesh all of that out.
Absolutely. I think once you start to understand how much is happening outside of your awareness and you start to really pay attention to those things. Now, experts say that 95% of our cognitive processes happen in our subconscious. So think about that. 95% of the things we think about, we don't even think about,
Right.
right?
Yeah, past
But
programming, whether it's genetic or programmed through the nature nurture thing, right? It goes, it's in tandem, so to speak.
once you become aware of some of these things like cognitive biases, we've talked a lot about confirmation bias over the last 4 years and this whole political thing that people are only going to search out information that confirms that which they believe to be true.
Right.
So confirmation bias has been out there all over the place. I suspect that people know what confirmation bias is, but I suspect that because it's
Now
really
has a label.
our awareness now and we can apply it in a very relevant sense to how we live. Like I notice it myself. I find myself nodding in agreement when I find a new article that confirms that which I believe to be true. And then I have to stop myself and say, okay,
Yeah,
now
what
what
else
do
is
I say to this?
possible?
And we know from intellectual humility is only acquired or it's a learned skill, and we only learn it by seeking out opinions and positions that are in direct opposition to our belief systems, which is
Right.
hard, right?
Well,
Challenging.
absolutely, because it confronts what we've held sacred, so to speak, and that instead of being reticent to express, it gives us the opportunity to have I think what's called empathetic conversations, which then lead to generative conversations, which allows people who finally at least have some sense of where the other person is at, and there's some congruence in that, and then be able to take that to a new level of questioning things further to flesh out how things can be better. So,
right. Right. And you know, I've done a lot of work in this concept of intellectual humility, because people, we all like to think that we're very smart people. Like, we want to believe in our smartness.
I know nothing.
but you know, when you think about intellectual humility, it takes real discipline, and it takes a very secure person to say, you know, Zen, I want you to tell me why I'm wrong, and then really embrace why you think I'm wrong, or be able to take a position that is in direct opposition to my belief system, my mental models of the world.
Right.
I mean, that is real intellect. That requires real intellect.
And even to take it to the generative place of, okay, maybe you're not wrong. Maybe you're just seeing things a little differently, and shifting that perspective to where there's a broader view, or at least exploration of the possibility of a situation. And you know, I kind of like the term possibilities coagulator, right? When you flush those things out, then you can pull out that often ephemeral understanding, and that 95%, we begin to move into that. Now, I've often wondered, and maybe you can give me some reflection on this too, is with that, and I'm just looking at the 10% model, right, where we've got five senses, and that is it possible that those five senses are distributed across other planes of consciousness in similar fashion, just in finer detail?
Mm-hmm.
Is that...
Absolutely. So I'm doing a lot of work right now. I'm working with a restaurant group, and I'm really digging this research on, you know, how all of our senses create an experience. Mm-hmm. So, for example, a dining experience. We taste that food long before that food hits our lips.
Right.
Right. We taste our food. We create a model of that experience by the music that we hear, the lighting, the way the hostess greets us, the weight of the menu even, you know, all of that. And what I've learned, and I just find this to be so fascinating, is that all senses are not created equal. Our vision is the most dominant sense we have, which is why they say, you know, it's 90% presentation. What we see on the plate before we taste what's on the plate is going to create a perception of what we expect that to taste like. But, you know, also what we hear. So taste is actually the weakest of our senses. So when you think about how all of our senses actually stitch together a perception of an experience, it's unlikely that we're thinking about in the moment, what do I hear? What do I feel? What do I smell? What do I taste? What do I see? Like, mm-hmm. We don't think that way.
No, because it's undisciplined.
Right.
You know, a person who, let's say, is an experienced meditator, or someone that has learned how to calm themselves enough just to pay attention to what's going on around them, and not be so engaged in thinking or sensing it. Although that's a natural process when you're in that place of acquiescence, I guess. Mm-hmm. You know, you're able to perceive at much deeper levels and just be with that rather than craft it or construct it in a thinking way. So right. How do we take that, or how do we become, you know, we've recognized that there is more. So how do we use that understanding in order to provide that invitation to experience more?
I think it's two things. I think it's attention and intention. So I think we don't most of us don't pay attention to what we're really paying attention to, because the things that are grabbing our attention and actually adding data points to our mood, to, you know, our response or reaction, whichever it is, those are all of the things that are kind of happening just below the surface. So we have to learn how to pay attention to that. And part of that is, how am I feeling? And I'm not, we have to get better at saying, you know, I'm not feeling sad, or I'm not feeling mad. Maybe I'm frustrated. Maybe I'm feeling intolerant. Maybe I'm feeling, you know, so we have to expand our vocabulary of emotional words, I think.
Right.
And we're not taught how to do that. And so I think that that takes some
work. Nor do we necessarily have the vocabulary.
Right. Right. There's a great book called by Dr. Mark Brackett called Permission to Feel. And if anyone's interested in, you know, digging into really being able to identify feelings better, he does an amazing job of laying out how and why.
I'll put a link to that in the description.
Okay. And I don't know Dr. Brackett. So, and I don't get like that was, I don't get paid to like promote his stuff or anything
right,
like
right.
that. But it is a really good book. And also he, there is an app that was developed from his work that is called Mood Meter. And you can actually track your moods. And what I have done now, without the permission of all of these really smart people, is I have connected those dots. And so Daniel Pink has done a lot of work on the science of timing. And you know, you can actually look at, there are certain times of the day that your emotional state is more conducive to doing certain things.
Right.
And if you can track that and you can figure that out, like some people are much more creative in the morning, some people are much more analytical in the evening, you know, whatever that is.
And the study of biorhythms has a lot to do with that.
Absolutely. And, you know, we have a collective as a human race biorhythm.
Right.
They've done, you know, there's been, they gathered all this data from Twitter, which I typically don't praise Twitter for much these days, but I will give Twitter credit for this one. They took all of these, analyzed like 250,000 tweets from, you know, 50 countries or whatever it was, and they actually saw that there was a common pattern, mood pattern throughout the day, throughout the week.
Kind of like the random number generators that are in space that are being monitored, and that actually show some patterns when there's major world events going on, the emotional changes in the planetary civilization, so to speak. So these are one of the things that also came to mind is, you know, back in the day, I think the ethnogens had the capacity with others in revealing those deeper things, because in the experience, I know for me, and I'm not ashamed to admit it, and maybe you have experienced that well, or as well, there are these deeper sensory capacity places that we go to, or some do, that go into the expansion of exactly what you're talking about. And whether, you know, that's just one path. There are many of the meditators and all that. So it doesn't really matter which path you take to get there. The reality or the invitation to do so is probably the greatest thing that you could accept in order to help build your own life and sensitivity and ability to communicate and your functionality. You know, we're talking about the being able to bring all of that stuff, all of the senses, all of the layers that we may be available and even those that we aren't, and bring those into some sense of defining or discovering or perfected form, fit, and function in the world, which is where our passion and purpose really congeal into something spectacular or potentially.
Potentially, yeah, absolutely. Absolutely. It's when, you know, when you really stop to think about all of the things that happen up here in our brains that we don't even know, and it makes us who we are. It makes us respond to the world around us, the way we do. But what becomes even more fascinating is when you are able to kind of ground yourself and be introspective and really look at, why am I feeling the way I'm feeling right now? You know, I've worked with a lot of folks in recovery, and we always say, the problem isn't the problem. The problem is always something else. Like, whatever it is you're complaining about right now, or that you're feeling that is the problem, dig deeper, because that's not the problem. And I think that for so many of us, it really does, to your point, it takes discipline. You have to be able to, you know, it's hard to step outside yourself too. Mm-hmm. When we talk about looking at the world through someone else's lenses, that is not an innate skill for us. We inherently see the world through our own lenses, colored by our own experiences. So to be able to say, I'm going to step into this person's shoes, it's not just step into that person's shoes and see it from where they sit, but the hard part is to understand that that person's position is shaped by that person's experiences. We Right. can't possibly know what those experiences are that shape another person's views.
And what we can do, and yes, and what we can do is be intuitive enough, and perhaps maybe even this is where this, you know, the life coaching thing has come out, and especially on the transformational side, which is what I do, is that intuitive questions of, okay, where, you know, somebody presents a stumbling block, and then we begin to peel the layers of the onion back in order to find where that really came from, if they can do so. And the common response is, I don't know. And so it's like, well, let's just play with it a little bit. What if you did know? Mm-hmm. Right? And what if you just explored? You don't have to be right or wrong, but let's just explore the possibilities there and take a look at it. And in that safe place, then it opens up the door for people to dig deeper.
I could not agree more. And I think that, you know, for us to be better in relationships, we have to first be better at our own self-awareness.
Absolutely. Right.
You know, it seems counterintuitive. It seems like, well, if my relationship is going to improve, then I need to figure out how I can be more empathetic and I can understand what that person feels. No, it starts here. You have to understand your own. You have to have a greater self-awareness first.
Right.
Because your self-awareness will inform the way you see other people.
Precisely. And Dr. Robert Gilman, who's my first guest, actually, his and he's been doing, you know, he's like a planetary midwife where he's trying to help birth this new awareness. And he says that it's really finding a place to be in harmony with self, others, and nature. And I would say even the cosmos, because that relevancy is there. And from my own experience, I've recognized that we are cosmic consciousness condensed into form. And, you know, some models, if you will, would call that the point of light that bounces back and forth between the great light and every incarnation, if that's part of your belief system, you know. But there are these things, these elements that are beginning to show that there is much more of a time frame involved that we might not be aware of, that's in and operational in the present moment. So in your studies, how have those kinds of things, there's also another gentleman, William Swigart, back in the 1950s, developed a multi-plane awareness technique that goes into those other planes of consciousness and our capacity to experience those. So are these kinds of things, do you see them coming to the surface now and people being a little more willing to explore and let alone understand what those are?
You know, I think since mindfulness and meditation and intentional breathing and all of that came onto the scene, I think people are, you know, there was a time that was all considered very woo-woo science. Well, now we can say, no, that's actual science. Your parasympathetic nervous system actually engages when you engage in diaphragmatic breathing, and your vagus nerve, which is the longest nerve in the body, actually goes down one side and up the other, and it sends signals to and from the brain, and you can actually decrease the production of cortisol, and you can decrease your heart rate, and you can decrease blood pressure when you're in those spaces. And it's science. It's
It's like
not
knowing without knowing.
right. It's not woo-woo. It's actual science. You know, I think more and more people are discovering that they can use these are tools for
Right.
them to actually live a happier, more productive life.
Now, do you think with this current situation we have globally and how it was initiated and what happened with the obsession on self-hygiene and sequestration, do you think that's promoting this inner quest to, you know, clean up our act too?
Maybe. Yeah, maybe. I think it's probably twofold. I think it certainly 2020 gave us all a chance to kind of sit with ourselves and think. We all had all that time and not a whole lot of distractions going on. And for those of us who really chose to get introspective, that was one of the silver linings of 2020 and the pandemic. I think the other thing, though, that happened was I think we recognize globally how important it is to be connected to other human beings, because we took that connection out, and you know, we saw mental health statistics skyrocket, and we saw, you know, the effects of isolation in the workplace and out of the workplace. We saw the effects that it had on kids who had to go to remote learning. So I think both of those things happened. And my hope is that as we're never going to go back to where we were pre-pandemic, and post-pandemic is not going to look like it does today. My hope is that if the last 2 years have taught us anything, we've learned that we're pretty complicated creatures, but it doesn't take a neuroscientist to understand what's going on up here and how it impacts the rest of my body and how it impacts how that is impacting my relationships and how relationships impact our communities and how that impacts the world. You know, it's that ripple effect.
Absolutely. And it's quite present. And, you know, the one of the things that I'd noticed was in one of the studies of productivity and the remote working, right? Initially, it escalated. You know, there was this concern that the workers wouldn't be as productive if they weren't in that work environment. Well, it turned out that was a fallacy, right? And maybe it was because people intend to do their best job, and without the constrictions of micromanagement, maybe they actually could, right? And yet then there was this plateau where productivity began to diminish a little. Now, of course, you know, with anything new, we get excited with the opportunity and the engagement of it. And then we kind of, as we get more comfortable with it, maybe we become a little more complacent with it. But how do you see in your work that opportunity to bolster the activity and the engagement and the curiosity in how to move forward in the best ways that we can?
So this is so funny, Zen. You and I have not had this conversation, but I'm actually delivering a presentation in Singapore, virtually in Singapore. But it is all about how we build psychological safety and emotional intelligence in the hybrid world. And one of the pieces of this presentation is, you know, in the very beginning, and even now, when you ask some people about this remote learning, this shift to remote learning slash working in the workplace, there are four pretty standard arguments against it. And one is that productivity will drop. I mean, I had a boss in my world, in my past, who said, how will I know if you're working if you're not in the office? And I think that there are still those—
No trust there, is there?
No, and by the way, my response to that was, well, you will just look at my work. My work product will tell you that I've been working, right?
Yeah.
But there was, you know, the other three are people won't innovate and collaborate. Hybrid environments are not equitable. So people in the office are going to be treated differently than people out of the office. And that ultimately company culture will deteriorate. And what we found—
That comes from such a limited alpha male silo kind of environment where, you know, you got to watch what everybody's doing. Don't trust them. Don't empower them, give them the tools and turn them loose, right? You got to have your thumb on them all the time just to make sure they're doing what they're supposed to be doing. Now, what I've, and you bring up that point, which is in the process of transforming to something new, because in my experience, I've been involved with groups around the world and online, and the virtual opportunities that have come out of this pandemic, for lack of a better, or plandemic, whatever it was, there is so much more, and people with the minds that want to be involved are gathering in groups, and there's been, it's like this, it's almost an amazing scheduled kind of event that everybody was participating in that nobody realized on an individual level how many others were doing the same thing simultaneously. And now all of a sudden this is coming to the surface where these groups, like the one that we belong with BizCatalyst, right? That's a perfect example where these people with similar ideas expressed differently are all working towards, you know, helping people, places, and things to work together better to create that harmonious environment that perhaps we were destined to experience as we evolve as a planetary civilization, and that this chaotic and transformative event gives us the opportunity to do so.
Mm-hmm. Absolutely. I think, you know, when I started to do this research on, well, what was the difference between these organizations who actually thrived in the pandemic, who actually, you know, debunked these four criticisms of hybrid work, you know, and I look at it like everyone else. I look at it through my own lens. And I actually wrote a piece a while back on my horrible boss story. I mean, everybody has a horrible boss. Right. But what's more important than the horrible boss is what's happening in your brain when you're experiencing that. And when I looked at the research about productivity and employee engagement that actually increased through the pandemic, the common denominator was these people, these leaders, prioritized psychological safety and said, we understand what we need for our people to feel psychologically safe. Now remember, the brain doesn't do a very good job of differentiating between physical danger and psychological danger.
Right. Well, even in the studies with athletes, and this is corollary, right? Whether they imagine or actually do whatever it is, the brain lights up the same way.
Absolutely. That all came from mirror neurons that was actually discovered by accident in a little research lab in Parma, Italy, with monkeys. And they had these monkeys hooked up to electrodes and they were watching their brain.
It's a new expression for the monkey brain, right?
Right? They were watching their brain activity when in relation to hand-to-mouth movements. And so these monkeys were all hooked up and they were studying their brain activity. And a research assistant came back from lunch with an ice cream cone. And the research assistant was eating the ice cream cone. And the monkey was watching the research assistant eat the ice cream cone, but his brain was activated as if he was eating the ice cream cone.
That's
the hand to mouth movements, the taste, all of the parts of the brain involved in eating an ice cream cone were activated and lighting up like a Christmas tree in the monkey, except the monkey wasn't doing anything but watching. So the brain, to your point, can't determine between things we imagine and things we actually experience.
Right.
Which is why when we think about bad things that have happened, our brain responds the exact same way.
Right. Now that also—
Likewise, when we think about good things that have happened, our brain responds positively.
Absolutely, which was kind of the point of our discussion the other day with the group. One of the other things that Tom Campbell brought forth, you know, the concept of being an avatar, and that we're in charge of creating our reality. Now, what you're talking about lives or gives credence to that capacity that we have of becoming that through disciplined awareness and thinking and actually choosing. And I loved how you put attention and intention. I'll include interaction. Mm-hmm. There's always that threefold fractal, right? In pretty much everything we do, we just don't necessarily see that third party, neutral, that's in there that's saying, oh yeah, you can do this. It is just, it's your choice, right? And so it boils down to, it's a choice to learn the discipline or become curious or be open to or engage in different ways. Now on a brain level, how do we perhaps find some practical, simple things to do to accentuate or even inspire or ignite those elements within us?
So a couple things. One is that whole idea of emotional contagion. I think just being aware that we can change the chemistry of someone else's brain in less than 60 seconds. So if I come into your office and I'm having just a terrible, horrible, no good, very bad day, and I'm wearing it all over my face because of mirror neurons, because we are higher life form and we have a sense of empathy, mm-hmm. and we know what it feels like to look like somebody who is having a terrible, horrible, no good, very bad day. I am actually generating those stress hormones in your brain. So knowing that, I'm responsible for negative neurochemistry in somebody else's brain. And
so what you're saying is we're all responsible for everything.
Yeah, we don't just coexist. Right? We actually share the human connection. I mean, we share a neural connection with the people around us.
Well, and now, it's even more than a neural, isn't it?
Yeah, but I'm speaking specifically about neural. So if you
right,
the flip side.
Yeah, you neuroscience geek, you.
I know. It's hard to be me, but somebody's got to be.
Exactly.
But the flip side of that is, you know, I share this when I go out and speak, and I say, you know, not in a creepy way, but in a very genuine and friendly way. Today, smile at as many random strangers as you can smile at. Okay, a couple things are going to happen. First of all, it's almost impossible not to smile back. When you make eye contact with somebody who is smiling at you, it is impossible not to smile back. That's yep. mirror neurons at work.
Yep.
But the other thing that's going to happen is we share this connection. It might just be that split second interaction, right? We'd pass each other coming in and out of the grocery store. You hold the door for me. I smile, make eye contact, say thank you. Your brain is going to start to produce those good, happy chemicals. The other thing that happens is you feel more connected to the universe. There's a person out there that you connected with. Now, human connection does not mean long-lasting, lifetime relationship. Human connection is just that, human connection. Mm-hmm. We need that. We need just that. And I think that's one of the things that came out of the pandemic that we didn't get because we were all, you know, clustered in our homes and we weren't going out and we were wearing masks. But think about this, we've worn masks now for almost 2 years. You can tell when someone's smiling behind that mask.
Well, yeah.
You can see the smile in their eyes. So, I mean, that is the human connection. That is the part, that's what separates us from potato bugs and other life forms, right? I mean, we need to use that to our advantage.
Well, and like the opening that I used too of the In La Catch, right? That I am another you. So for me, I'm responsible for me. I'm going to be the best me so that you can be the best you.
Exactly.
And that smile and that eye contact and that imbues that moment with a much different energy.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So that's one thing. So I'm going to give you three practical strategies, three
awesome.
Practical takeaways. That one is understand that what you communicate on the outside of your body impacts what happens on the inside of somebody else's body.
Mm-hmm.
It just does.
Mm-hmm.
So that's number one. Number two is this, a whole idea of diaphragmatic breathing, that Breathing is the single best way to tell your body, I'm okay. I'm not gonna die. And sometimes, you know, our ancestral hand-me-down is to be constantly on the lookout for danger. I mean, that is what...
That's go back here, right?
Yeah. And it enables us to survive extinction for millions of years. And, you know, today we don't have to be on the lookout for the saber-toothed tiger in the bushes, but there are times where our survival brain is engaged when it doesn't necessarily have to be. And so the best way to disengage the survival brain, if in fact you are safe and there is no saber-toothed tiger behind the bushes, is to breathe. Deep diaphragmatic breathing actually increases oxygen to the brain. It slows the heart down. It tells the whole body, you're okay.
And I include, you know, putting your fingertips together and feeling your heartbeat at the same time, because you can include that and it really adds a lot to what you're saying. The diaphragmatic breathing is all important. And yet there's that, you know, that next level stuff that, oh yeah, I can get in touch with my heart too, which gets you out of your head.
Yeah. So I talk to people and I say, are you into meditation? Are you, you know, no, not really. Can you breathe? Because if you can breathe, you can make it work for you. And that is the first step in meditation, is just controlling your breath, focused breathing, right? Then, you know, I think the third thing is so simple that it's often so forgotten, and it's gratitude. When we express gratitude to another human being, we actually get a greater neurological benefit from that than the recipient of that gratitude.
That's the essence of namaste.
Absolutely. Absolutely. So like, you know, you say to yourself, can you challenge yourself to every Friday or whatever the end of your work week is? Maybe you say it's gonna be your Saturday morning thing. Sit down with two thank you cards. Reflect back on your week. Who did I come in contact with? Who did I exchange some kind of, you know, human connection with this week that I really appreciate? It could be, you know, a coworker, it could be a neighbor, it doesn't matter. But sit down, write that out in a thank you card. And we have forgotten how to write thank you cards. We totally have. Dear Zen, thank you so much for having me on your program. I enjoyed speaking with you so much, and it is so much fun for me to get smarter about my craft talking with someone who's smarter about his craft. You've just made me see things differently, and I am so grateful. Let's do it again soon. Best, Melissa. That is a meaningful thank you. But how many times do you go, hey, thanks for having me on the podcast. It was great. Tell them why. Right. Tell them why you appreciate it. Because in doing so, what it does is it reinforces why it's meaningful to me. Sure. It reminds me of why this was so good for me.
Right. And it's that process, right? It's like extending the scientific method, right? Where you have a hypothesis, you test it, and there's a repeatability in that, but we're looking at the repeatability of data results or data-driven results from that perspective. Well, it's the same for the process that we engage in this kind of behavior, right? It's a repeatable process that you can use over and over and over and over again. And it will take you to some unimaginable heights in your life that you probably don't even realize you can go to yet.
Absolutely. It's, you know, it's crazy. I mean, I get that not everybody cares about what's going on between their ears the way I care. Mm. But when you really understand it's those simple things, and what a profound impact it has on your cognition and your mental acuity. And, you know, it influences everything. It influences the way you see the world.
Well, from a quantum physics perspective, you know, we're in this physicality, we're still 99% space. Mm-hmm. So there's this limited, and maybe this is a function of the electromagnetic spectrum in which we operate. And yet there's that space, you know, that perhaps there's a greater consciousness that's in that space that is managing things, that is just looking for opportunity to show up in our lives because we learn how to pay attention.
Absolutely. Zen, you just made me think of, there's been a lot of work done on the science of awe. Why we need to bring awe into our life and experience awesome, things in the world. I'm going to give you that link, and if you can share it in the show notes, it's just amazing. And this whole concept of, there are two ways to look at you being so small in this universe that's so amazing and so vast and so there's so many unknowns. You know, on one hand, you can say, I'm so small, I can't make a difference. I can't, I'm so insignificant. But on the other hand, it is that sense of awe that just makes us realize how amazing life is, how amazing our brains are, how amazing our relationships, how important those relationships are, how important it is to really embrace that human connection. Even if it's just a blip on the screen of our day, it's important. And you never know how important it's going to be for that person. I mean, everybody's fighting a battle we know nothing about. Remember that. That smile could be the difference in that person's day.
Absolutely. And just that, again, discipline to have that present in our awareness to at least and find ways to, and maybe this is a question this is waiting to be born, right? How do you suggest developing that, I want to say trigger point, but I don't want to pull it, right? It's something that promotes the ability to stop, look, and listen, right? How do we do that?
Yeah, John Lubbock summed this up in a quote. He's a very old guy. He's been dead for a long time, but his words live on. Pay attention to what you pay attention to. That's not what he said. What he said is, we find mostly what we're looking for. The way I translate that is, pay attention to what you're paying attention to. If you're paying attention to all the negative people, places, and things, then you're going to find negative people, places, and things. But if you're paying attention to all the positive people, places, and things, then that's what you're going to find.
Absolutely.
The brain is a busy place. It can only.
And it's funny, even the questioning of those kinds of things. My wife and I were on honeymoon in the Yucatan, Tulum, and we were on our driving to Chichen Itza. And we were talking about self-awareness all morning long and all the indicators of it. We're going through this jungle road, and all of a sudden there's a clearing, and there's two signs in English. And they say, observe your intentions and observe your distractions.
Oh, good one. I love
that. It doesn't say engage. It says observe, because then you can engage in the ways that you choose are most appropriate. But that, just having that synchronicity, that connectedness, and those, who knows how the universe worked to put all those things together years ago when it first happened. But there it was for us. In the middle of our conversation as a universal punctuation point for it that revealed this awe that you just spoke of. And even when you brought the term up, I felt a release of some kind of chemicals in my body because I had this warm, gooey, feeling.
Yeah.
Right. And that's what you're talking about is exchanging that kind of feeling for one of constrictions and tenses and what I often call the butt pucker effect, right? Because we clinch when we're afraid. Well, when you look around in situations and there's no reason to be afraid, then why be so?
Right. We have to be smarter than our brains sometimes.
Isn't it wonderful? Oh, and it's such a pleasure to talk to someone who is so engaged between their ears.
Well, it has been a pleasure speaking with you as well. And my thank you that I used as an example was genuine. I
can feel it.
I love learning from you, Zen. And so thank you for the opportunity.
Oh, and ditto. It's all about sharing.
Yes.
And sharing our different perspectives, realizing we're saying the same things from different perspectives, and collectively we build this new model so that more people can understand and engage it.
Yes, absolutely.
And that we can have a new world in the way that we imagine that it can be.
Yes. Thank
cool.
you.
Cool. Well, again, thank you so much, Melissa. I appreciate your time and your attention and your intention and the interaction that we've had today.
It's been very special. Thank you.
Cool. And namaste and in la ketch. Thank you all for tuning into this episode of One World in a New World. I'm Zen Benefiel, your host, and I'll see you next time.